Well, Origins, our new series in Genesis. To understand who we are, to understand anything really about our situation, you have to go back to the beginning. Where have we come from? Why are we here? What's the point of life? There's been a bit of a craze, it seems, over the last 5-10 years for filmmakers to make prequels to sort of famous series. So I suppose most popular recently, the Star Wars movies. Out in the 70s and 80s came the big three. And then George Lucas goes back and films, well, three more Star Wars movies to explain, well, who is Darth Vader? How does it work out that Luke Skywalker is his son? What's the backstory that created this whole world, this whole sort of fight between the dark side of the Force and the Jedi? What do we need? We need a prequel, an explanation of the background for why we're here. And Genesis, if you like, is the prequel to the rest of the Bible, particularly chapters 1 to 12, which are the first block, really, of Genesis, set up so many themes that shoot off almost like rockets throughout the rest of the Bible. And they explode, just like fireworks, into full colour in the New Testament. So we get more detail in the New Testament. We get more, just a far clearer idea of the result of some of these themes. But they begin, their fire, the ignition, is in Genesis. As we look at this first passage of Genesis today, the creation account, you'll be aware if you've been a Christian for any time at all, or in fact if you're not a Christian and have just heard the passage before, you'll be aware that it's quite controversial, that there are all sorts of debates that come off the back of it about science versus God. Are we to take it literally, or is it just poetic? Now we will look at some of these this afternoon, but obviously we can't look at all of them. There are books and books, there are libraries full of books written on pretty much exactly this question. But the point of Genesis, was never to engage exactly in these kind of debates. It does speak to them, but it wasn't why it was written. Genesis was written, most of it at least, it seems, by Moses. Now Moses, as you may remember, died leading the Israelites into the Promised Land. So he took them out of Egypt, and he died just before they got in. So it was probably written in the desert for a tribe of nomads. And at no point would an Israelite who'd just been saved from Pharaoh, been through the Passover, the plagues and all the rest of it, at no point would he want to sit down with Moses and sort of pose questions like, look, Moses, we know the speed of light. We know that there are galaxies and nebula that are trillions and trillions of years away. So how does that fit in to your chronology in Genesis 1, where it seems there are 24 hours? Neither would he have questions like, look, Moses, we found fossils. We've done geological studies that can sort of date rocks. How does that work with what you wrote in Genesis? They just weren't concerned by that kind of question. It's not what they were trying to get at. And it wasn't the point of what Moses was trying to write. You see, the Israelites, and in fact the peoples of the ancient world, already had all sorts of explanations of where they came from. You might have come across some of them if you did sort of, I don't know, looked at the ancient Greeks at school or the Romans. And often there's stories where gods fight amongst each other. And they tend to be incredibly bloody and violent. One god sort of rips open the belly of another and throws his entrails everywhere. And they form the heavens and the earth. Extraordinary stories. And Moses was writing Genesis 1 to counteract that kind of pagan understanding of where we're from. Effectively, it was an apologetic. An apologetic just means an argument. To, if you like, take down one understanding and put in its place another one. And so I don't make any apology, therefore, for spending some time at the beginning this afternoon, which we'll turn to now, of doing just that same thing. I think very few of us probably believe that the world was created when Marduk ripped the head off Thallus and spilled his entrails across the universe. It's not a popular religion nowadays. But if we've grown up in Britain at least, various other understandings of our origins are incredibly powerful. And they, just like the Bible, set off those rockets that have consequences further down the line. So, for example, if the whole world just came about by accident, if it was purely spontaneous, if it had no designer behind it, well, that sets off a trajectory, a rocket, if you like, that explodes into the application that we are also here by accident. There's no purpose to your life. You're just a collection, essentially, of space dust. You're not going anywhere. You're not here for any reason. You just kind of happened. It was an accident. You are essentially pointless if there is no designer. but far from it. So let's dive in and have a look a bit more at how Moses counters this kind of teaching. The first thing I want to do is a bit of ground clearing, if you like, on this topic of science and the Bible. You may have heard it said that the two are enemies. And if you want to be a Christian in the 21st century, you've either got to stop taking the Bible too seriously, or you've just got to switch off your brain and ignore science. We can choose, sort of Dawkins and co tell us, between a scientific explanation of the world or a biblical, but they are not complementary. But actually, that's a huge mistake. I've told this story before at Duffield, and I got it hideously wrong, so I'm going to try it again. It's a story about a recipe, about making a cake. Now, if you make a cake, and this is where I tried to wing it last time, you need certain ingredients. So you need flour, eggs, sugar. See, I'm learning. You pop them in a dish. You put it in the oven. Now, last time I guessed at about 80 degrees centigrade, I was told that was far too low. So I'm going to go about 300 this time. Close? No, 200. I'm trying to look at some experts. Let's say 200. Anyway, flour, eggs, sugar, 200 degrees, in the oven, leave it an hour. What comes out? A cake. Now, you could give... Ish. You get the point. Ish. Now, you could give a fully scientific explanation of a cake. Eggs plus flour plus milk plus sugar at a certain temperature combined to produce cake. But it would be stupid to argue from there that there is no other way of explaining cake. It could equally be a perfectly reasonable explanation to say, well, the cake exists because I wanted to bake a cake and I made a cake. You don't have to choose between a theory that explains the physics about how the eggs and the molecules dissolve into each other at certain temperatures and a theory that says, well, it was someone's birthday party and I wanted to make a cake. They go hand in hand. So to try and make them fight against each other is just silly. Similarly, if Wayne Rooney scores a penalty, you could explain it in terms of the physics. You know, his leg travelled at X miles an hour, made contact with the leather ball that propelled it at a certain degree towards the top corner of the goal. You could give a scientific explanation, but you could also explain the same action with completely different stories. So Wayne Rooney wants the glory of being the greatest ever centre-forward for Man United. He wants to win an England place. He wants to earn his salary in order to be able to feed his wife and children. And so he practiced and trained to become a great taker of penalties and scored a goal. Now, those are both two different accounts of the same event. They're both true. And so it is with science and Christianity. They are both true accounts of the same thing. And you'll know probably that Christians, real Bible-believing Christians, disagree about how exactly the beginning of the world came about. On the one hand, you've got guys like Francis Collins, who was the guy who mapped the human genome, American scientist, a top-level guy. And he believes that essentially it all came about, human life came about more or less the same way as you get taught at school in terms of evolution. On the other hand, you've got guys like John Lennox, who is a professor at Oxford, Edgar Andrews, a professor at London, and they reject, even though they're top scientists, they reject evolution as an explanation of human life. Some people hold to 24 hours literally. Others think it's figurative. There's a range of opinions that real Bible-believing Christians hold. And what that means, and the reason I've started here, is that if you're not a Christian, you cannot use science as your weapon against the Bible. You cannot use science as your weapon against the Bible because they're answering different questions. And even inside Christianity, there is an internal debate. You see, God reveals himself in two ways. We learn this, in fact, from the Bible. One way is called general revelation. And that's all the things that he creates. Okay, the world, the universe, the stars, and all the things that happen in history. And when we try and interpret the world around us, the universe, we call that science. God's revelation is the stuff, and our interpretation of it, our account of it, is called science. Similarly, though, God reveals his special saving plan for the world. That's known as special revelation. That's basically for us now the Bible. So again, we've got the objective thing, the Bible, but also we've got our interpretation. You know, sermons are the preacher's attempt to faithfully understand the Bible, or theology books. Well, just as you've got the world out there, which is interpreted by humans in science, and you've got the Word, which is interpreted by humans in terms of theology and sermons. The fact is that the two go together. God's revelation never clashes. The world and the word never clash. The problem comes with our interpretation, and we've got to admit, if we're honest Christians, that we can get it wrong on either account. So we can misunderstand the world. We can get science wrong. We know that. If you look at the history of science, people are always getting things wrong and learning and changing. Science is constantly changing. But similarly, we can get the word wrong. It could be that we just misunderstand the Bible. And so we set up a false conflict with science that is never even there in the first place. And if we're going to be humble, we'll let both camps speak to each other. It's perfectly okay to let science help us understand the Bible. It's not that we always have to start with the Bible. There are many things that you use to understand the Bible, in fact, if you're a Christian, that you didn't learn from it. You didn't learn, most likely, what a brother was from the Bible. You learnt it from your family. And then when you read about brothers in the Bible, that helps you understand what it means. You didn't learn what a king was from the Bible. You learnt about it from history. And then when you read the Bible, it helps you understand what a king is. Similarly, as we look at science, it can help us to go back to the Bible and understand it further. So what do we have to believe? What are the facts, as it were, in Genesis 1? Essentially, there are two areas of debate that Bible-believing Christians split on. One of them is evolution, which basically we're going to ignore today. Leave that for next week when we look at the creation of human beings. The other one is basically this thing about the age of the Earth, the age of the universe. Science basically says that the universe is about 14 billion years old, and the Earth is about 4.5 billion years old. The stereotype Christian view came from a guy called Archbishop Usher in the 1600s, and he calculated, he calculated the world began at midnight on Sunday, October the 23rd, 4004 BC. He did that by adding up all the ages in the Bible, and he reckoned he could get it down even to the minute. Okay, which is a pretty extraordinary effort. So what you have inside Christianity are basically two camps. One are often known as young earth people. They think, essentially, that the days that Matt read to us are exactly 24 hours. Okay, just like days are nowadays. When people come to them with evidence, primarily two things. The universe is old. First of all, rocks that have been radiometrically dated. And say, look, these rocks are much too old for that. The young earth guys say, well, that's because of the flood that we'll come across in Genesis 6 to 9. All that water, all that pressure made the rocks look a lot older, created all these fossils. And when people come and say, look at the light that's taken billions of years to get here from galaxies far, far away, the young earth guys say, well, look, when God made the world, according to Genesis, it already looked old, didn't it? Now, if you think about Adam, when Adam was 1 second old, he already looked, well, for the sake of argument, 21. So just because you look at something in the world and you reckon you can judge its age, doesn't necessarily follow that that is its age. God made a universe that had light already arrived. He made trees that if you did cut them in half and counted the rings, would give you the impression they were 150 years old, whereas actually they were just 10 minutes old, said the young earth guys. I don't actually personally follow that view. Okay, that's not my personal understanding. But I just wanted to mention it because I think sometimes we do a disservice to our brothers and sisters who do hold to it, and some of you may yourself hold to it, when we mock them as just sort of ignoramuses who bury their heads in the sand. There are good guys who hold to that sort of thinking. I've mentioned two of them already. One teacher at Oxford, professor of science at Oxford, and he holds to it. So let's not mock our brothers and sisters. I don't know, they're always Americans. We put our fingers and think, you know, they just won't engage with science. No, there are sensible people, intelligent people, who think that way. Personally, however, I'm not convinced that's what Genesis 1 teaches us. There is another camp, as it were, broadly defined, who hold that the story, although true, and giving us a real account of what God did, is effectively a somewhat poetic, big picture summary of the main points. I'm not going to dive into all the details. But essentially what we're given is the pattern of God's working week. 6 days he creates and one he rests. Later on in the Bible that's picked up in the Ten Commandments when we're told, or the Israelites were told, to work 6 days and rest one. Now, a day, what is a working day for God? You've got to remember, when this was written, if you walked up to an Israelite and said, I'll meet you at 3:20 for a drink, that meant nothing. They didn't have clocks and watches that tick-tock. A working day was just, you got up in the morning, you worked until you finished your job, and then you stopped. Well, for God, when he gets up on day one and decides to create light and darkness, how long does that take? How long is a working day for God? Well, who knows? Who knows? It's just an analogy, a picture, to mirror our working days. And some of the details of the passage, I think, help spell that out. So look down at verse 1 and 2. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was without form and void. The heavens and the earth he created in the beginning. The heavens there are the invisible heavens. That's the place where God lives. The place where he shows himself. The place that we can't see with telescopes or our own eyes. Where he dwells now in unapproachable light, we read later in the Bible. It doesn't just mean the stars. We know that because later on, further on in the account, out of the earth is formed the heavens, verse 8. He calls the expanse heaven, i.e. the sky. So initially he creates the spiritual realm, verse 1, and the earth, which just means the physical realm. But there's a problem, if I can put it like that, in verse 2, with the physical realm, the earth, the universe. The universe was without form and void, empty. So this isn't blasphemous. Essentially, it's just a big pile of mush. Okay, in terms of the poetry of the passage, okay, he's created stuff, but it is without form. It's like a lump of Play-Doh that hasn't been shaped yet, and it's empty. And what happens in the next 6 days of creation is, on the first 3 days, he creates it into form. He solves the problem of being formless, and on the second three, he fills it. And so the days link up. Day one links up with day four. So day one deals with the problem, if you look at verse 3, or creates rather, light and dark. So out of the just general mush, suddenly we have light and dark. But on day 4, what does he make? We'll have a look down. At verse 14. On day 4, he said, let there be lights in the expanse of heaven to separate the day from the night. And verse 16, God made two great lights, i.e. the sun and the moon, the greater light to rule the day, the lesser to rule the night. Day one, he creates light and dark, so he gives a bit of form to this world. Day four, the parallel day, he makes the sun and the moon, the rulers, as it were, of the zone that he's just made. Day two, what does he make? Well, again, have a look down. He makes the sea and the sky. That's verse 6 through to 8. He makes the zone, the sea, and the sky. So when he comes back to it on the parallel day, day 5, what does he make? Well, he makes the things that fill the sea and the sky. He makes fish and birds. That's verse 20 onwards. Let the waters swarm with swarms of living creatures, and let birds fly above the earth across the expanse of the heavens. And similarly, as we'd expect, on day 3, what does he do? Well, he creates the land. Between the seas. So verse 9 onwards, let the waters under the heavens be gathered together in one place, let the dry land appear. So suddenly you've got oceans split up by continents. That's the form. How does he fill it? Well, day 6, the last remaining day that parallels day 3, he makes animals and human beings who live on the land. You see, all the way through, he's dealing with this problem of it being formless and empty. So 3 days, he forms the three zones, and on days 4 to 6, he fills them. And actually, if you just flick over to the end of the story, we're not going to pick through all the details. Chapter 2 and verse 1. That's the conclusion. Thus the heavens and the earth were finished, and all the host of them. The heavens and the earth are finished, so all the form is finished, and the host, the people who live in them, the things that dwell in them, were filled in and put in them. It is essentially a poetic account of how God works. Forming and filling, giving order to the chaos. So what? But so what? Okay, and this is, I guess, where it gets really, if you're a Christian at least, more important. It's Genesis 1. It's not just given us so we can have a debate with non-Christians about where we came from. It is a polemic, an argument against the other religions of the day for the Israelites. What does it tell us? Well, we're just going to note three things. First of all, it tells us that there is only one personal God. Okay, there is one personal God. If you ever looked at the Egyptians at school, you had to sort of study them. It's a classic class project, isn't it? You might know that the Egyptians worshipped all sorts of different gods. They worshipped the sun, for instance, and the moon. The river Nile had its own god. All sorts of different gods. And so the Israelites had grown up, having been enslaved by the Egyptians, in that sort of world, where they thought different things, as it were, had their own god ruling over them or in them. No, says Moses, there is one God who creates everything. God created the heavens and earth out of nothing. He has always existed. The universe had a beginning. And he has no rivals. It's not a fight between God and Satan, between good and evil. Everything is created by God. And initially, as we see at the end of every day, it was good. Did you see the refrain as we went through? God saw that it was good. God created everything on his own. Now, we don't most likely worship the sun, the moon, but perhaps we've fallen for this lie that actually the universe, far from coming from one personal God, came from just an impersonal beginning. That is the religion that is most widely propagated in Britain nowadays, isn't it? One of the most eloquent and widely respected advocates of that is Stephen Hawking. And his latest book, The Grand Design, he says this, and this is his, okay, Stephen Hawking, you just couldn't get more eminent as a scientist, could you? This is his most up-to-date theory about why you don't need God, the God of the Bible, but you can stick with his religion, that of naturalism. He says this, how did the universe come about? Quote, because there is a law of gravity, the universe can and will create itself out of nothing. Okay, let me read that again. Because there is a law of gravity, the universe can and will create itself out of nothing. The Grand Design, published a year, perhaps two now ago. How do you get from there being nothing to there being something, Stephen Hawking? Well, because of the law of gravity, he writes. And it's obviously incredibly more complex than that in the way he spells it out. But that is where he drives to. And he gets panned. If you read any of the reviews of the book, on the whole, they were incredibly critical. Because actually it explains nothing, does it? The law of gravity means the universe will create itself. All sorts of responses came back. Where did the law of gravity come from? I mean, it's just such a mind-numbingly obvious question. And you think, surely he's thought about that, but he still doesn't deal with it. And secondly, what can a law do? A law doesn't do anything. This is an old objection to this kind of thing. C.S. Lewis uses this illustration. He talks about the law of bookkeeping, okay, in terms of banking. So £1,000 plus £1,000 equals £2,000. And Lewis says that that's fine as a way of describing what happens. But the law itself, the laws of maths, will not themselves grow your bank account. If you want to earn money, you can't just open an account at Lloyds TSB and say, well, the law of arithmetic says that 1,000 plus 1,000 is 2,000, and so I'll go back in a few weeks, I won't put any money in, I'll go back in a few weeks, and the laws of arithmetic will surely have grown my account. Well, of course they won't. The only way your account will grow is if you have stuff that you put in. The laws don't do anything. They're just a description of physical processes. Now, where did the universe come from? It cannot have created itself. A law cannot create it. And we must fight back, actually, as Christians, against this nonsense that is shoved at us under the guise of science, where actually it's just another religion or a philosophy. Someone else commenting on the likes of Dawkins and Hawking compared them to footballers and said, I've no more reason to listen to Stephen Hawking and Richard Dawkins when they put on their white scientist coats and tell me about the origin of the universe than I would Wayne Rooney when he puts on his Man United shirt. The white coat and the football shirt neither have any more authority in them to tell us about where the universe came from. We're so impressed with science nowadays that we think that somehow it's got all the answers. It hasn't. They have always been religious questions, philosophical questions. Science can take over from 2 seconds later, a second later. It cannot explain the origin of anything. C.S. Lewis also points out the same thing goes with evolution. The basic process or the philosophy behind evolution was held by the ancient Greeks and some of the Romans, way before Darwin or anything else, because they realised you basically had two choices. Either there is a designer, a god or gods of some sort who make things and you know, create, or it happened essentially by accident, with things just, you know, atoms bumping into each other on and off and on and off, and it just came about by chance. And the Greeks, who didn't want a personal god creating everything, they realised, therefore, it must have been, so they argued, by all these atoms bumping into each other and changing, and essentially an early form of evolution. The startling thing, says Lewis, is that the theory of evolution came way before the evidence. Essentially, you've got two choices. Have we been put here by a personal god, or are we here by accident? If we're here by accident, if there is no personal god at the beginning, then you are not personal. As we said earlier, you're just space dust. No, there is a personal, one personal god who made you and therefore owns you. He's also in control of everything. Think back to the Israelites and all the gods they knew, these polytheisms, it's called, many gods. There were two different sorts. One was the kind of gods we know from the ancient Greeks and Romans, where there's a god of war and a god of wisdom and a god of beauty and a god of power and a god of the hearth and a god of farming. A different god was in charge of different zones, different things, different activities. Or there was a different kind of polytheism. That was the kind that said, well, there's a god of Israel, a god of Egypt, a god of England, a god of Wales. That's zones. Okay? And that god was in charge, but only in charge in his country. If you were an Israelite, you had a god in Israel, but when you went into Egypt, you better swap and worship the god of the Egyptians, because that's where he held power. No, says Moses, God created the whole of the universe. There is not a square inch where he is not Lord. You remember back to our previous series. And now we might think, look, we're not going to fall for that sort of nonsense polytheism where we worship different gods. But again, subtly, we do. Of course, God, Jesus, is Lord of our religious life, we say. But actually, when it comes to bringing up children, we worship the God of middle-class aspiration rather than the God of the Bible. When it comes to work, we worship the God of success. And when it comes to a choice about being pragmatic and just quietening down on the Bible versus being fully serving the Lordship of Christ, well, we slightly leave Christ behind because work isn't really his zone. And we become pragmatists. We serve the God of success. My relationships with the opposite sex, God's so old-fashioned. It's not really his zone. So I serve the gods of pleasure, where I indulge myself. The God of sex. No, there is one God who rules over all. And there is only one God, therefore, who is to be obeyed. He's in control of everything. And until we get this in our heads, not just our own personal lives, but even our life together will be a mess. If you follow any of these Christian organizations like Christian Concern or the Christian Institute, they're always bringing up debates are happening out there in politics or the wider world about rights and the clash of different rights. So on the one hand, you've got the right to free speech, we're told. You can say what you want. There's no restrictions on what you say. On the other hand, you've got the right not to be offended or abused. And the two kind of clash. If you're allowed to say anything you like, how do you curtail that? How do you put boundaries on that? If you've got the right not to be abused, can I just tell you to shut up every time I don't like it? Well, there's a clash. Why? Because people have just cooked up random different rights that don't fit together. There's no harmony to them because they have not come from God. Only when we put God back at the centre will we bring unity to our society, to our laws, when we listen to him top down and not try and create our own ways of running the world. Even our legal system is effectively polytheistic. But finally, and perhaps this is the most important thing from Genesis 1 as we come to a close, see that he creates through his word, by his spirit. Through his word, by his spirit. Verse 1 and 2 again. Verse 2. The earth was without form and void. Darkness was over the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. He's created the heavens, the invisible heavens. You've got the earth, everything else there, and the Spirit is over it, hovering over it. And God said, "Let there be light." And there was light. As God speaks his word from the heavens, and as it were, in the imagery, it passes through the Spirit, or is carried by the Spirit to the earth, to the universe. Things are formed. Light, darkness, seas, oceans, mountain ranges, animals, ultimately human beings, as we'll see next week. It is through his word he creates. What are we to make of that? Well, firstly, there's a practical point, that God's word is the thing that brings order and harmony and creation to the universe. It is his word, that keeps things running, which means that if I ever go against his word, as we now have it in the Bible, if I ever ignore it and decide to go my own way, I will find that life just will not work. Because the way God has set the world up to be is through his word. It is his word that rules it. And so if I divert from it, I'm just heading towards a crash. We sometimes think that God has given us all these rules almost to make life hard for us. Do not do this. Don't murder, don't lie, don't cheat. Be sexually pure. We think these are burdens. In fact, they are the way that life works, going with the groove, as it were. Because God's word blesses. He wants us to enjoy the goodness of creation. But actually, is that rocket of the firework, as it were, goes on through the Bible, we see that it explodes in something far greater. We're going to close with this. Just flick right on to the Gospel of John. John chapter 1. It's page 1068. What do we have in Genesis 1? God creating the heavens, speaking his word through the Spirit, and the world is created. John chapter 1, in the beginning, echoing Genesis already, was the Word. And the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. That Word has become a person. He, verse 2, was there with God. You've got God and this character Word. Verse 3, all things were made through him. That's the Word. And without him was not anything made that was made. You wouldn't spot this necessarily in Genesis 1, but that "and God said" is a shadow, the lighting of that rocket, as it were, that actually is Jesus Christ. God creates through Christ and his Spirit. How do we know that it's Christ? I look down into the passage. Verse 9, the true light which enlightens everyone was coming into the world. Who is it? Verse 14. The Word became flesh and dwelt among us. The Word became flesh. It's Jesus. So if you want to live in harmony with creation, if you want to understand the world around you, you have to live under the lordship of Christ. And that will bring blessing, not cursing. That will bring you in harmony with the universe, not against it. And that will put you in a right relationship with the Lord and Creator of all. Romans 11 says that from him, Christ, through him, and to him are all things. And can I leave you with that question?